Before we get started, I want to remind you that the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, is now available on my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and on eBay. It's the same price in either place, but if you just want to have a variety of ways to get it, there you go. Someday it'll be on Amazon, and then I'll be rich, rich beyond my wildest dreams. So I hope that you will get it. And if you want to learn more about it, I have a Facebook page, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, so find that, and you can find pictures and all sorts of cool stuff, even things that aren't in the documentary. So you can find out all about it there.
Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 45 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. Tonight I'm obsessing over the Kennedy assassination as a way to avoid sex with Alison Porchnick. Actually, truth be told, we will be obsessing over the Kennedy assassination a little bit later on. First, let me get some business out of the way. I want to remind you that you can go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and I will always have links to my guests' books and videos, and I hope that you will go through and order them. And when you do, through my site, then Amazon will kick back a little bit to me. Also, on my site, thecommentarytrack.com, I remind you, is the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, and I just told you that probably 45 seconds ago, but can't be repeated too often. Hope that you will go there and order that, and order books by my great guest, including my guest tonight, Joseph McBride. You can also support the podcast by simply hitting the support button. It'll take you to PayPal. This is on the homepage of thecommentarytrack.com, and you could just put in a few shekels to help keep this thing afloat. And believe me, it is leaking like a sieve, so any generosity that you can muster up would be mighty appreciated. But you don't even have to do that to support the Commentary Track. You can do it without spending one red cent. And that's by going to iTunes and leaving a nice review and a five-star rating, and that is most appreciated. And otherwise, just keep telling your friends about it. I think we're growing and we're getting more and more. When I was at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival a few weeks ago, several people walked up to me, people I never met, and told me how much they enjoyed the podcast. And when I realized that people I don't know are listening, that's very encouraging to me, because I figured it was just 18 of my best friends. But actually, there are 18 of my best strangers listening too, so I'm very grateful for that. So please spread the word. Keep listening yourself, but anybody who's interested in film, I hope that you will let them know about it. Tonight's episode is a little bit off track for a podcast that is devoted to film, although we do talk about film, and we do talk about movies related to the subject. A lot of this talk is simply about the Kennedy assassination. That's because my guest is the great film historian Joseph McBride. And I always knew that he had campaigned for Kennedy when he was a kid and had always been very interested, but I was not aware that he had spent years and years of his life investigating the Kennedy assassination. And all that has resulted in a book that I really found totally fascinating. It's called Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit. It's really an interesting book. I am no expert on the subject by a long shot, although, like most people who were alive at the time, the assassination cast a certain shadow over my entire life, and there was a time, because I was just a kid when it happened, but I still remember how terribly dark and depressing that whole period was, and Joe and I talk about that, and he talks a little about his, not only his theories, but things that he has pretty much nailed down. And he's done some really serious research over the course of 30 plus years. So that all came together in this book, and I think you'll find it fascinating. So enjoy this conversation with Joseph McBride, and we will see you on the other side. To set up talking about Kennedy in film, I'd like to talk first just about the nature of how film depicts history in general. And it's something that I've been led to think about because obviously I've written books on the Alamo and on Lincoln in film, and I've written a lot about the Titanic, and so I write a lot about historical events and how they've been transformed. And normally I'm not real concerned with what kind of liberties are taken, because I figure that's all part of the not only the myth-making process, but just the way that we learn to digest what happened in certain ways. And I think that myth is a doorway to fact in some important way. What do you think about that sort of thing? I mean, I guess I'm thinking more specifically about more recent things and events that happen now. I'm sure there's going to be a Zimmerman Trayvon Martin movie sooner or later, and probably sooner. And so we have to brace ourselves for somebody taking a specific point of view and slanting their viewpoint toward that instead of being a documentary, but many people will take it as truth no matter what they see.
Sure. It's a very complex ethical and aesthetic question. The answers are not simple, as you suggest. That, for example, when we look at Shakespeare's history plays, which are great, they're stylized. Their parts of them are in verse, parts are in prose, but they're also about events that happened a long, long time ago that Shakespeare, you know, reshaped history according to his own ideology and his aesthetic needs, and we respond to them as dramas, and I don't think very many people get upset about changes that he made in history. But, you know, when it comes to something we know because it happened recently, or we've seen it on television, which is such a pervasive window onto the world, that Shakespeare's audience didn't have that kind of thing. They weren't at the Battle of Agincourt with the cameras and stuff, so they had to take his word for it to some extent. Oscar Wilde wrote that history is just gossip. So there's a sense in which history, even written history, it has to be taken with a grain of salt to some extent. And a lot of historians have, embellished things, and that's frowned on today. But you know, every history work or biography, there's judgment involved in selection and how you present things, and you shouldn't make things up in historical books. But in film, there is more license, I think, that filmmakers should be granted, because they are dramatists. And I'm talking now about dramatic films, not documentaries. There's some different issues involved there, but we'll get to that in a minute. But I think that some historical dramas get unfairly attacked for taking some dramatic license that they have to take to make it an entertaining and dramatic film. But, you know, when it comes to something that's very sensitive, like the Kennedy assassination, look what happened with Oliver Stone's JFK. There was a tremendous controversy over that. Or when you take something like Birth of a Nation, people are still, they get very angry about the distortions in that film, and they write books about how it relates to the actual history of Reconstruction and the Civil War. And so these issues are very important, and the film Lincoln brought up some of these questions. What was left out of Lincoln, for example, what they emphasized. So this is a perennial discussion, and I think in relating to the Kennedys, they were very largely a media family, and Joe Kennedy Sr. was a movie man. He was an early film executive. He was running FBO in the 20s, and then he helped found RKO, and was real mogul, and he, you know, famously made Queen Kelly with Eric von Stroheim and then terminated the production, and he had that big romance with Gloria Swanson, and Fred Thompson, the Western star, was John F. Kennedy's favorite movie star when he was a kid, and his father was producing Fred Thompson films. And so Joe Kennedy also sponsored a seminar at Harvard in the 1920s on film, which was possibly the first academic seminar of its eminence, you know, at a great university, which was his alma mater. And they put out a book of the papers presented on films. And so it showed that he was taking film seriously and trying to present it as a study, you know, worthy of academic study, and as well as a money-making operation for him. So he was very wise at the media, and he gave his children movie cameras. And so there are documentaries. Harrison Engel did a documentary recently of Kennedy home movies, and there have been other ones before where we see the Kennedy children playing around and doing family things. And so they were taught to how to live their lives in front of cameras. And Joe Kennedy also, David Nassau's recent biography mentions that he advised Franklin D. Roosevelt, who he worked for, on how to perform for the movie camera. And he would be with him sometimes when he would do newsreel appearances. And Roosevelt was very good with being on the camera. And, of course, Roosevelt was tremendous media presence with the radio. Sure. The fireside chats were one of his great achievements, and so he kind of led the way in making radio an important political medium. The first John F. Kennedy sometimes is called the first movie star president, but that's actually not correct, because as my friend Harrison Engel, who he had as a guest recently, pointed out to me some years ago, Theodore Roosevelt was really the first movie star president. Harrison made a good film on TR, and he found a lot of the early newsreels that were hidden away at the Library of Congress. And in the early days of film, Theodore Roosevelt coincided happily with the coming of motion pictures. And so the newsreel cameras loved him. They lionized him, and he was such a handsome, charismatic guy that they would follow him around on safaris and sure. all his political events. So he was a movie star in that sense. John F. Kennedy comes along, and he's more properly, I think, the first TV star president. He understood that new medium and made it work for him. Harry Truman was the first president who was on television, live TV, from the White House in 1948, and then he didn't really use it in any notable way. And Eisenhower, I think, was rather stiff on television.
Yeah.
Although he gave his famous farewell address where he talked about the military-industrial complex, which is a great speech, but he reads it rather kind of stiffly. It's interesting. He had Robert Montgomery, the movie actor and director, as his television advisor. And Montgomery was around the White House a lot, and he would coach and stage Eisenhower's TV appearances and probably improved him to some extent. But you could tell that actually there's some stories about Ike disparaging television and thinking it was beneath him to... The TV was not terribly well regarded in the 50s.
You know, Wellman directed Eisenhower.
Right,
Lights, Diamond, Jubilee.
Right, exactly.
And even Wild Bill could not coax that much of a performance out of him.
That's funny because, you know, I mean, Eisenhower was a very charismatic, handsome guy with his famous smile that captivated people. And when you look at newsreels of World War II, he's very engaging on camera. But something about sitting at a desk talking to the people on TV made him uncomfortable, whereas Kennedy just thrived on TV. And you know, you could say, and a lot of people have said, that he wouldn't have won the 1960 election, which was a very narrow squeaker anyway, without television, especially the first presidential debate. Those were started for that election, and I was watching, and I remember so vividly how, first of all, Nixon came off very badly in that debate. He looked bad. He was ill, and he was uncomfortable and awkward.
He seemed to be sweaty, whether he was or not.
Yeah, that's true. There was later he insisted that the TV studios be chilled for his appearances because he had a bad tendency to sweat, and he had the 5 o'clock shadow you know, and that shouldn't really be that important, but television makes those things important. But Kennedy, when you look at the tapes of that, he's very calm, relaxed, handsome. He took the opportunity to rest up, and Nixon was cramming like a student for the debate and getting anxious, whereas Kennedy kind of relaxed that afternoon, and he had a tan, and he looked presidential in the sense that he looked comfortable with himself and confident, and Nixon looked like a shifty used car salesman.
Yeah. He'd had a lifetime of working with the camera. I mean, because of his father and because he'd given them cameras, and they knew how to put their best foot forward. And they were, you know, he was also just a photogenic man. He was a very good looking man. So, I wanted to backtrack just a little bit about, TR. Roosevelt not only was a big movie presence in newsreels, but he was being dramatized even while he was in the White House and just before and after. There were fictional movies made about him with actors playing him.
Right.
And even animated films starring the teddy bears, which were teddy bears, as some people may not know, are called that because T.R. on a hunting expedition refused to shoot a mother bear because he saw that her cub was nearby.
Right.
And this made headlines around the world that he was a hunter, but a hunter with a heart.
Yeah.
And so, so they started making these stuffed bears and calling them teddy bears.
Yeah, and they made the movie The Rough Riders, which glorified him. That came after his time, but it was a silent film, which only partly exists. But, Lincoln, for example, has always been, from the early days of film, a favorite subject. I just gave a talk in Ireland at a John Ford symposium held by the Irish Film and Television Academy on Ford's many treatments of Lincoln. Also, his brother Francis, who is a silent film director and actor. In 1913, Francis played Lincoln six times that year. He was obsessed with Abraham Lincoln. And, just an interesting aside, I did a biography of Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, and we were watching Reagan getting nominated in 1984 on television. I happened to be with Capra, and so we started talking about, obviously, here's Reagan was a movie star who became a president, which before that people thought this is strange that an actor would run for president. But Reagan made a very profound comment to Michael Deaver, who was his media guy. Deaver said, "Does it help you as president to have been an actor?" And Reagan said, "I don't know how you can be president without being an actor," which I think is very sharp because it is an acting job in a lot of ways. You're kind of the pitch man for the United States. You're up there, kind of putting the best face forward on our country and dealing with difficult issues takes a lot of aplomb. So Capra and I were watching Reagan, who, a good-looking guy and all that, and I was saying, Lincoln, if he were around today, wouldn't succeed in politics because he's too homely. And Capra said, "No, I disagree." He said, "Lincoln must have been very charismatic from all we've heard." They had the Lincoln-Douglas debates. 20,000 people would show up, and Lincoln may have been homely and all that, but people liked that. He had this kind of interesting, authentic look, and he was a physical giant, and he had a kind of beautiful, homely face in a way, too. But the point is not really whether you're homely or not. It's do you have charisma, and can you connect with the public? And Capra very correctly knew that about Lincoln, that he could connect with the public.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. I mean, certainly his political enemies made a great deal of how ugly he was.
Right.
And he was often derided for looking like an ape and having this squeaky, horrible voice that nobody liked to listen to.
Well, even in this new film by Spielberg, some people were surprised that Daniel Day-Lewis has a kind of a high tenor voice.
Yeah.
But that's the way Lincoln talked.
Absolutely.
And actually, once you see the film, it seems perfectly appropriate. But we were
everybody
used,
talked about it.
Yeah, we were used to people playing Lincoln with a deeper voice. But now people say, well, if you look at pictures of Lincoln, he was kind of beautiful in a strange way. He was a strange-looking man, but there's a great quote, somebody said, "There's no great beauty which hath not some strangeness."
Yes.
So John F. Kennedy was more conventionally handsome, but there were a few odd things about him. His eyes kind of were divergent, and his smile was a little crooked. But Norman Mailer wrote a terrific essay on him in Esquire in November 1960 called "Superman Comes to the Supermarket," which was amazingly prescient about the dangers of the 1960s that we were about to get into, that Kennedy was an existential character leading us into, he said, America needed to walk into the nightmare, which is where I got the title for my book, Into the Nightmare. And Mailer said that Kennedy was like Gregory Peck, who is a very handsome guy, a little stiff. He said that Gregory Peck never seems totally comfortable in his roles, according to Mailer. And he had the feeling that Kennedy didn't quite feel comfortable in his role. But I was a volunteer for him in 1960 when I was 12, and I was very taken by him, as a lot of young people were. And actually, I liked that quality of Kennedy. I saw him up close, and I watched him on television. I liked the fact that he conveyed that he was a little above the sleazy aspects of politics by being a little uncomfortable doing some of the rituals. Like Eisenhower and Nixon would always wave their hands over their head, and he swore that's the one thing he would never do. He thought that was vulgar. So he had a sense that there were things vulgar about shaking hands and kissing babies. He did some of that, but he always acted a little aloof from that and had a sense of detachment and irony that he conveyed, which impressed me because I thought it showed intelligence and wit. And he had that great wit where he would make fun of himself and the rituals that he had to go through. And that conveyed sort of a sophisticated view of politics, which I found very appealing at the time.
I grew up in South Carolina, and that was not a Kennedy-supporting place in my childhood. I was 8 when he was elected president, and I can remember having, I think in the second grade, or it's about right, second grade, we had a mock election in our class, and we all voted for Nixon because our parents had told us that Kennedy would be taking his orders from the Pope, and he was going to lead us into this Catholic future that, for some reason, our parents found horrifying, that he would have this other boss that would always mean more to him than the United States.
Well, I remember that well because I came from a Catholic, Irish Catholic family, and that was part of his appeal for us, that here was an Irish Catholic who was seriously considered. And my mother, who was vice chairman of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, Marion McBride, remembered vividly the 1928 election where her uncles and her father were crying when they would hear all the anti-Catholic bigotry on the radio against Al Smith, who was, you know, a very engaging guy when he campaigned on the streets of New York, but he was very Irish, and that was held against him. And so we thought it was great that Kennedy might get elected. He had to face a certain amount of prejudice, which he faced very directly. He gave a great speech to the Houston ministers, Baptist ministers, and dealt with the religious issue and pointed out that nobody asked his brother Joe Jr. what his religion was before he got killed in World War II, for example. That was a great line. But he, in Wisconsin, in the film Primary, which is a classic documentary about the Wisconsin primary, which I happen to be in the crowd in that film. I can't point to myself, but I know where I'm standing in this big, the big centerpiece of the film. Kennedy gives a speech to 3,000 people in Milwaukee, which is very exciting, and I was there. There's this very intimate scene that night when he's, well, 2 days later, when the returns are coming in, he's in his hotel room in Milwaukee, and they let the camera crew shoot him, which today most politicians wouldn't do this. So Kennedy's smoking a cigar, which you wouldn't catch a president doing on camera today.
Seemed presidential then, though.
Yeah, it seemed sexy, and you know. But he was also speaking very candidly about some of the frustrations that I just thought, well, he won the primary, but he felt it was a real blow because he expected to do better. And he won the urban areas that were more Catholic and more liberal, but he lost a lot of the Protestant rural areas. And he says in the film, the religious issue, you know, keeps coming up. And one of his sisters said to him, what does it mean? And he said, it means we're going to have to do it all over again. We're going to have to win every primary from now on. And he had to go to West Virginia, which was a very Protestant state, to show that he could win with Protestants. And so the religious issue was still a potent problem for him. But he overcame that, and there was a myth at the time that, and a lot of people still think this, he was the first Irish-American president. Actually, there were 8 presidents before him who had Irish ancestry, like Ulysses S. Grant's mother came from Ireland, for example, but they were all Protestants. So the Catholic thing was the breakthrough. But, you know, we still haven't had a Jewish president or an Italian president.
Mm-hmm.
And other ethnic groups haven't broken through, and there's still some prejudices against certain things.
There are prejudices against everything.
Yeah, even though we have an African-American president who's half white, that was a big deal. But why can't we have a Jewish president or an Italian president?
Yeah.
Or a woman, obviously. It hasn't happened yet, but I think it will soon.
It'll all happen. I mean, sooner or later, all these doors have to be opened.
But I
want to talk a little bit about the coverage of the Kennedy assassination, which I remember extremely well, and I guess everybody who was alive then or sentient then remembers that whole period, this horrible weekend, where it just seemed like the whole world was engulfed in gloom to me. I think I just turned 11, I remember the whole period of just being a dark
time. You remember it well.
Time.
Yeah.
I remember it very well.
Yeah.
And you couldn't escape it. You couldn't. We only had 2 or 3 TV channels.
Yeah.
And just a few radio channels that we could get in rural South Carolina. And so everything was the assassination 24 hours a day.
Yeah, that was
hence
the, that
we were
was
watching the, when Oswald is killed, and we saw that live on person, you know, on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But every element of that experience, and I think that's got to be the first time that every channel devoted itself for days on a single subject.
I think that's true. And today it's become the norm on cable TV when there's some big event.
Yeah.
They all swarm on it, which I think is unfortunate in a way. It's understandable for the Kennedy assassination riveted the country. It would have been considered offensive if they had had entertainment shows. And they even stopped all commercials. The networks lost a lot of money on the loss of commercials. But the one exception that weekend, I mean, some people went to the movies and to bars and all that, but part of it was to get away. There's some books on the public's reaction to the assassination that were done at the time by sociologists, and there's one that quotes various people as saying that I found the television coverage oppressive. One woman says I had to walk around the block to get away from it because it was driving me crazy, but she said then I went back because I couldn't stop watching. A lot of people said that I was riveted, and it was a ritual for our country that it held the country together. And in my book, Into the Nightmare, I talk about how that had a double-edged effect, that a lot of people said that was a good thing, that it kept the country from falling apart and getting into anarchy and all that when the president was murdered. But I think in a way it was bad because it, as one of the books said, it had a narcotic effect on the public. It was like a drug that calmed everybody down and made them not want to act. It paralyzed the desire to act. And in a lot of countries, if the leader is murdered and there's a military coup, which I think this was, people will take to the streets and fight back against it, and maybe we should have done that, or we should have been more active in challenging the official story. And instead, we were lulled by this brilliant coverage on television. Like, the funeral was beautifully directed. I found out the man who directed it was Arthur Kane, who was a CBS guy who was in charge of special events, and he had 60 cameras. He ran, it was all pool coverage. The other networks ran what he put together, but they had 60 cameras in Washington, and it was all very beautifully staged by Jacqueline Kennedy and her brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver. But it was, there were a lot of kind of dubious aspects to it. It kind of evoked the Lincoln funeral in many ways, which was a big national event that went on for weeks, where the funeral train was going through the country. It's even an orgy of grief that transcended the Kennedy rites. But in this case, the whole country, 93 million people were watching the funeral. And it was beautiful and majestic, and Mrs. Kennedy was very grand and regal. And yet it took you away from questioning what happened. You know, they weren't covering, you know, the networks kind of were not investigating the story the way they should have. And the press did some investigation, and then kind of that petered out. They didn't do much independent digging. They just kind of took the official story that was being handed to them. And so I say it's like a four-day docudrama that we experienced. That was, you know, the protagonist gets unexpectedly shot. Some people might have expected it. I could go into that. But it was a big shock. And then all these lurid characters come into play. And then by the third day, the villain of the piece gets murdered on camera. And then the fourth day, there's this specious sense of closure. I don't like that word closure. I don't think there is such a thing.
No.
You know, like if you lose a loved one, who to me, Kennedy was a loved one. And these books point out that for most Americans, it was experienced as like a death in the family, that he was somebody that we related to as a family member. Some people didn't like him, but he was a father figure to the country. So it was like losing your father, or your brother, or whatever. And you really never get over that completely. The wounds heal to some extent, but, I mean, I still feel a raw wound from that event, and I always will, even though I've written this book, which I thought might be somewhat cathartic, but it's not very cathartic. I still feel pretty much
for sure
terrible about it. But, you know, it was a docudrama, very well staged. Dan Rather, who's made his career off the Kennedy assassination, literally had vaulted him from being an obscure correspondent in that region to being a national figure, and he's done a lot of specials whitewashing the Warren Commission and spreading the official story. He said in a documentary on CBS for the 25th anniversary that the Kennedy assassination was the answer to my prayers, which was really shocking.
I read that quote. It's just unbelievable.
I couldn't believe it. And then even the person who was interviewing him for CBS said, well, could you, you know, explain what you mean? He gave him the chance to correct his comments, and he tried to backtrack a little bit, and he just meant that it was this tremendous story. Of course, it was very sad, et cetera, but it was, you know, it was the story of a lifetime, which it was. But then he went on to say that the day that meant the most to him is the day nobody talks about, which is the fifth day, which was Tuesday, the 26th of November, the day America went back to work, is the way he put it. And he said 200 million Americans went back to work, and the country continued, and they did their jobs, and the government was stable. And frankly, to me, that day was almost the worst. I remember going back to school that Tuesday feeling completely bleak and devastated that, you know, it was this terrible sense of loss. And I didn't feel consoled or relieved that the government still stood or anything like that. You know, my world had been shattered, like probably a lot of people felt that way. But for Dan Rather, that was a satisfying conclusion dramatically.
I think that was the... That was the aim, to make us feel as if we had gone through this terrible thing. Now it's over. Now we're starting anew.
Yeah.
Stronger than ever. It's the way Americans always like to think of ourselves as, okay, we've been knocked down, but we're getting back up and we're moving forward. And so the fifth day is simply us saying, okay, we're going to dust ourselves off and,
there is something good about dusting yourself off. I mean, in World War II, for example, the British had that attitude that when they were getting bombed by the Nazis, that people would put up signs in their shops and stuff like, you know, keep bombing us, we'll carry on. You know, that's admirable. There's a certain admirable trait to that. But in this sense, the idea that life would go back to normal, to me, didn't happen, because it's not normal to have your leader killed and his successor be suspected of the crime and all kinds of questions swept under the rug. The country changed fundamentally and has never gone back and probably never will. I think a lot of the problems we've experienced in the last 50 years stem from that event. We're still reaping the terrible legacy of that. But it was a moment of terrible disorientation. Don DeLillo, a great novelist who writes very well about that event and other disruptions in our country, said that was the time when we were disoriented from reality, that reality that we thought we lived in no longer pertained, that, you know, it was like ripping the veil off the, you know, we thought we lived in one kind of country, and yet it was a different kind of country that could be changed by gunfire. And not that it hadn't happened before, like with Lincoln and McKinley and almost Franklin D. Roosevelt almost got killed, but there was the whole secret world underneath the secret government, and we started to learn things about the CIA and the military that we were naive about. At least I was, and a lot of people were. And over the years, it's been very educational for me to study this event and its ramifications, because you learn so many things about how the government functions in reality compared to what we were taught in civics class in grade school, you know?
Yeah. Before we get into how you started investigating this case that led to your new book, I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about the films that have been based on the Kennedy assassination. It seems to me that these are all great examples of what we started out this podcast talking about. And that is, each one takes the event and filters it through some sort of viewpoint. And they almost all come from a point of paranoia. Almost every film about the assassination comes from the viewpoint of something was hidden from us. Something was done in secret, and we were not privy to what was really done.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody's ever done a Kennedy film that didn't come at it from that way, have they?
Well, there have been all kinds of Kennedy films, docudramas about the family and about Jackie and Jack. And, you know, there's been a certain amount of hagiography in some of these, and kind of romanticization. You know, and some of the books as well, actually, books on Kennedy and his presidency stop at the point of the assassination. That's kind of a weird trope in some of them, is they don't even deal with it. And you'd mm-hmm. think that if you write a biography of somebody, how the person dies should be part of the biography. But there's certain books that just leave out his death. They just stop, like, okay, we know this. And they don't mention Oswald, who was accused of killing him. And it's sort of like, maybe it's a recognition that the author is not sure what happened. But I would say that it is true that most of the films, at least the better films, deal with that atmosphere. What you say is that we don't know a lot of things that we find out in the course of this film of how things really work. The word paranoia is kind of a loaded word, because that's used a lot to criticize people like me, who are assassination researchers. We're often labeled paranoid, which is a clinical term, which means, you know, it's a delusional state. But
sure.
Richard Hofstadter, the famous historian, wrote a famous essay in 1963 it came out that month, which was about what he called the paranoid style in American politics. And this became the template for a lot of people's talking about how people who question the government are paranoid because they're not in touch with reality. And it was a very conservative essay, and it's been used to kind of try to shut down discussion. Usually when people say the words conspiracy theory or paranoid in the media, that's like a code word for let's stop discussing this because you're crazy and you're beyond the pale to bring up. And so that's, you hear that a lot on TV. Somebody will start saying something that's unorthodox, and then the host will uncomfortably say, well, I'm not into conspiracy theories. And then they always move on.
Sure.
Because the person who's saying it becomes, you know, feels threatened. But I understand that, you know, when they apply it to films, there is a, people often talk about paranoid thrillers of the 70s, for example. That was the period when there were a lot of these kind of films. And and some very good films, but they were, and some of the characters may have felt paranoid, but you know, a paranoid is, well, there's a famous quote from William Burroughs that paranoid schizophrenic is the fellow who's just figured out what's really happening. Stanley Kubrick was very impressed by that quote when his screenwriter on Full Metal Jacket told him that, Michael Hare, and he said, let me write that down, I'm going to tell it to everybody. So you can have fun by turning it back on itself. But I mean, there are people who are delusional, who think that somebody's following them who isn't or whatever.
Oh, sure.
But you know, when something like this happens and the official story doesn't make sense, the one guy fired three shots. He was a bad shot, and he was using a rifle that didn't work very well. I mean, the rifle that he was allegedly using, and he was actually in the second floor lunchroom at the time, which would have been quite a feat to shoot the president from the lunchroom. There are a lot of, the story doesn't make sense, so that's not paranoid to question that. But to get back to films, there are all these wonderful films like The Manchurian Candidate came out before the assassination. Yeah. That came out October 24th, 1962, which was the Wednesday of the week of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was not a good time to open a film because the country was very preoccupied.
Sure.
And that film kind of got overlooked to some extent. It became a classic later. There's a myth that it was withdrawn because of the assassination, but that's not actually true. It kept playing for a while. But it's a great book by Richard Condon. It came out in 1959 about a brainwashed GI in Korea who comes back and is used as a political assassin by a right-wing senator and his wife, who actually are communist agents. It's a brilliant novel. I've read this many times. Highly recommend this book. It's a terrific, satirical, but deeply disturbing book about that things are not what they seem. That it was kind of based on the idea that Joe McCarthy, as people said, nobody could have done more for the communist cause than Joe McCarthy, ironically. And that's kind of what happens in the book, is that a Joe McCarthy-type figure is exposed as really being a communist agent. So that kind of that fits this paranoid-style thing that we're talking about, that things are not what they seem. But Hofstadter was reacting against McCarthyism largely, that McCarthy was a paranoid huckster. He would say there, you know, 224 communists in the State Department, whatever. He would make up these figures.
Yeah.
And in the film, they parody that by having the senator trying to figure out a number, and he picks up a Heinz 57 ketchup bottle. 57 communists in the State Department. And that's just making stuff up. That's paranoia,
sure.
You know, and exploiting the paranoia of the public against the Russians. And so there were films before the assassination that kind of captured that bubbling ferment that and confusion.
Yeah,
and
suddenly is a little bit.
Suddenly,
like that.
Yeah, I remember watching that as a kid. You know, Frank Sinatra as a guy trying to kill the president, and I would say The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a great film from 1962, John Ford's great western, is very much a prefiguration of the assassination because it's about a killing of a outlaw who is terrorizing this town, and the man who allegedly shoots him turns out that he didn't shoot him, so we're not told the whole story. It's about the press covering up what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And John Wayne, in a flashback, is shown shooting Liberty Valance from a shadowy alleyway with Woody Strode helping him, and it's like the grassy knoll in the Kennedy assassination. Here's what really happened, folks, from an angle you didn't see. And so Ford was kind of, like a lot of artists, had his finger on something that was going to happen. I actually wrote a short story in October 1961 about the Kennedy assassination, oddly enough. When I was a freshman in high school, I wrote a story called The Plot Against a Country. And it was a rather bad cartoonish short story when I was a kid. And it was about a communist plot to kill Kennedy, and it succeeds. And I was sort of, you know, raised as Catholic schoolboy. I was sort of indoctrinated with anti-communism, so I envisioned a East German communist plot. But at least I had the sense to realize from my reading of history, and I knew the Lincoln assassination, that events like that usually are a plot. So I was kind of prepared for that. I wasn't so naive that I thought it was always just a lone gunman, which is the American mythos. But in Europe, they tend to think assassinations are usually a plot, because to kill the head of state is not an easy thing to do.
Well, sure.
It's hard for one guy to actually do that. It can happen, but more often you have to compromise people on the inside. And a lot of assassinations happen where the bodyguards are either involved or are compromised, like Indira Gandhi was killed by two of her bodyguards, for example. And the president of South Vietnam, Diem, and his brother were assassinated in also in November 63 in a military coup. And that kind of thing is more the norm. So I wrote this short story. I borrowed the murder method from a Superman comic book. But I had some elements that were part of what happened with Kennedy. I talked about the autopsy and the FBI investigation and things like that. And it's odd to me, and I was trying to remember when I was writing this book why I would have written a story like that 2 years before it happened. As far as I know, that's the earliest treatment of that by anybody. There was an attempt on his life in December 1960. I may have known about a deranged man was going to blow him up with dynamite and had a car full of dynamite, and it would have killed him, but he came out of his house in Florida with his wife and daughter to go to church, and the man didn't want to kill Mrs. Kennedy and Caroline, but he was captured. And also, what I think, though, I was really taken by was when I was a volunteer for him in 1960 at the event shown in Primary, I went to shake his hand afterwards in a receiving line and got his autograph, and I had a Brownie movie still camera, and in those days you had flash bulbs that were...
Sure.
That make a big flash. And so I blew it off in his face. I stuck it 3 feet from his face and blew it off in his face. It was like a big explosion. And I realized immediately that I was terribly rude and I was so embarrassed. And he looked really shocked. But then he quickly recovered. He was so poised that he smiled and sort of laughed. But it must have shaken him up a bit. And then I think I realized how vulnerable this man was if you could get that close to him and blow off an explosion in his face. The picture is in the book. It's a little out of focus because I was too close.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd been a few feet back, I would have had a better picture. But I think I was aware, and I had seen him at a rally near my house where I got to spend some time with him and talk to him about Profiles in Courage, and we mingled with him. And he was there with only three aides, and none of them was a bodyguard as far as I could tell. So he was pretty exposed and vulnerable, and I think I was aware of that and concerned about that.
Yeah, I think he's the turning point, isn't he? I mean, I think all of the presidents had been pretty exposed to the public. Lincoln had an open-door policy at the White House. If you had a grievance about something, you could go up there and
Until the 30s,
wait around. Yeah,
there wasn't even a gate around the White House. You could walk up and the presidents would have, open house. Every once in a while we could go and... Yeah, part of Lincoln's day, you could walk in and tell him you wanted a job or had a grievance. And Garfield was shot by a guy in a receiving line. And then, Kennedy changed things because they don't ride in open convertibles anymore. Johnson did some of that, actually. He was kind of recklessly still doing some of that. But it's now they ride in basically a tank, Obama's car is this heavily fortified car that can repulse chemical attacks and has all kinds of armor and weaponry and all kinds of stuff. And it's sad in a way because the president really is insulated from the public. And I've seen other presidents, and, they are still vulnerable, though. I mean, they do risk their lives when they show themselves in public, which they have to do to some extent, but they're surrounded by concentric circles of Secret Service men, more heavily armed and more alert than before.
And they all tend to walk in their inaugural parades.
Yeah.
And that always makes me feel a little queasy when I see that.
Yeah, Carter started that, and so they all feel they have to do that. But, when they do that, now it's become like they only walk for a block or two, and it's all heavily choreographed and planned. But, anything can happen. Unfortunately, in an open society, that they take a certain risk. And my father, the last time I saw Kennedy was 1962. I was an usher, actually called an honor guard at this event in Milwaukee where he gave a speech. And My father got to meet him. He was a newspaper reporter at a reception ahead of time for VIPs, and he asked him one question. He said, "Do you ever worry about being assassinated?" And there weren't too many people who brought that up to Kennedy. And Kennedy told my father, he said, "You know, I'm aware of that, of course, but I couldn't do my job if I worried about it, so I don't think about it. I just keep it out of my mind." And one could argue that maybe he should have been more aware of it, because there were a lot of threats out there against him. Now, presidents get threats all the time, and there was a book called Secret Service Chief by U.E. Bauman in 1962, which I read, that talked about how the threat level had increased when Kennedy got in office. He was a polarizing figure. And he talked very candidly in that book about the dangers of motorcades and open windows and stuff, and I read that. It's a very interesting book. But Kennedy should have been more aware of, there were plots against him. There was a book by a Secret Service man, Abraham Bolden, that said there were many rumors that month that he was going to be killed, and one of his advance men warned him the day before that they had reports that he was going to be killed in Dallas, and he just sort of shrugged it off. And a congressman from Texas said he was very worried. Other people told him, "Don't go to Dallas," and he just kind of shrugged it off, you know, because he was doing his job, and he also wanted to show that he wasn't afraid of Texas, but maybe he should have been.
Yeah, and to ride in the open car like he did, it just made it...
Well, and they stripped the, you know, among the things that are very suspicious is that some of the normal Secret Service protections were not in place that day, that normally they would have motorcycles riding alongside the car, and the police were told to have the motorcycles behind the car and ahead of the car. So he was unprotected. No Secret Service man was riding on the car, as often happened in motorcades. One jumped off the car, Clint Hill, the car behind, and got onto the car, but it was too late. And the car was going too slow. It was going 11 miles an hour, which is against regulations. It made that hairpin turn onto Elm Street, which is also against regulations. And the driver hit the brakes when the shooting started, and the car came to almost a complete stop, which gave the shooters a perfect final headshot or shots. So there are a lot of failures of protection that I think I wouldn't have believed this a long time ago, but I'm convinced the Secret Service, some of them were in on the plot. There's a guy named Vince Palomara who has studied the Secret Service a lot and really did an exhaustive job, and he's documented a lot of these failures. Like one thing, and this relates to film, that in those days the presidential limousine was preceded by a truck of photographers. And you still see that sometimes in motorcades. The newsreel photographers and still photographers had a truck that would get good shots of the president. And in Dallas, that motorcade, the numbers for all the vehicles were changed at the airport by two Secret Service men. They took the numbers off the windshields and changed the order of the parade so that the truck was left behind. And the nearest photographer car was several cars behind, too far behind to get good shots. And so it was left to amateurs pretty much to cover the assassination, although an Associated Press photographer, James Altkins, happened to position himself at the exact place where Kennedy was shot and got one great photo of the limousine under fire. But he had Kennedy in his viewfinder. He was 15 feet away when the fatal shot occurred, the headshot, and he was about to take the shot, and he froze because he was shocked, which is understandable.
Sure.
But, you know, he really, it was uncanny that he positioned himself there. But most of the photographers who took the pictures were amateurs, including Abraham Zapruder, who was an amateur home movie enthusiast who took the famous, he wasn't the only one, you know, Nightline, some years ago, did a show where Ted Koppel said Zapruder was the only person who got the assassination on film, which is ludicrous.
Sure.
There were 10 people who took movies in Dealey Plaza while it was happening. Not all of them got the shooting. Some stopped right before the shots, but other people got parts of the shooting, and there were about 20 or 30 still photographers there taking pictures. You know, so it was a pretty well-covered event, but it was the amateurs beat the professionals on that occasion.
Well, the Zapruder film is not only arguably the first assassination film of the cycle that would continue up to this day.
Right.
Because we have one coming up, you know, Parkland coming up soon.
Yeah.
But it's also a remarkable document. And I know that you've seen the restoration that they did a few years ago, because as it turns out, 8mm film, the sprocket is actually within an image area.
Right.
And so by developing the entire image, you're almost getting a 1:85 aspect ratio.
Yeah, except you see new information in the sprocket areas that we didn't see at the time.
Yeah.
Well, the Zapruder film is, I tell my film students at San Francisco State that the three most important American films, historically speaking, are The Birth of a Nation, Citizen Kane, and the Zapruder film, for different reasons. The Zapruder film was tremendously influential, and without it, we would have a harder time understanding what happened that day. There was another film that was taken from across the street facing Zapruder by a woman called the Babushka lady. It's hard to say that. She was wearing a babushka, and she took you can see her taking a movie and panning the camera, and she had a great position. She was showing the grassy knoll, and whoever was shooting from up there, she would have captured on film, and the Kennedys in the foreground. That film has never surfaced, and some people think the FBI took it away from her, and some woman came forward and said she was that lady, but she was a fraud. But anyways, Zapruder's film was quite remarkable, and he kept the camera pretty steady, which is quite a feat when, you know, you're hearing gunshots going off around you. And he thought the shots came from behind him, some of the shots anyway. There were shots from different directions. Some did come from the Texas School Book Depository. The Dal Tex building next to it, there was probably a shot from there. And there were shots from the grassy knoll, and Zapruder was sort of in the middle of all that. He kept his camera going. He sold it to Life magazine, and there's a fellow named David Rohn who wrote a book on the Zapruder film. He said it's very strange that such an important piece of evidence would wind up in the hands of a magazine and not in the hands of the American public. And recently, the National Archives bought the Zapruder film from the family, and they paid $16 million for it, which is a huge amount of money, and they didn't even get the copyright, which is, I find, incomprehensible. They have the film, but not the copyright. The copyright was given to the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, which is in the Texas School Book Depository, and they're devoted to perpetuating the lone gunman theory. And so, but Life magazine bought the film. The first time we saw those images was that Tuesday after the assassination. Life printed some frames in black and white, and then the following week they came out with some color images, and that was really, I remember that vividly. I went down to a magazine store that Tuesday to get Life magazine, because we were used to relying on Life. When I was a kid, if something big happened, you would wait for Life magazine to cover it, like the Andrea Doria sinking. They always had a photographer who happened to be there, you know. And the newsreels weren't very good in those days, and that took a week or two to come out. They were black and white. The television news was black and white, and they didn't have much, you know, it took a long time to get, somebody would shoot some footage in Vietnam. It would take days to wind up on TV before satellites and things like that. But the Zapruder film was quite revealing. However, and again, this is one of these discoveries that I made over time. A lot of good researchers that worked on the assassination that I've learned from. One reason my book, Into the Nightmare, took me 31 years of research is that it's such a complicated story, and there's so many people who've written about it. I've learned a lot from people, as well as doing my own interviews and archival research. But there's been a controversy about the authenticity of the Zapruder film, and I was an agnostic until recently. People claim it's altered, and I now believe it was altered, seriously altered. Life magazine damaged it. They admitted they lost some frames in processing, which is kind of hard to imagine how you could do that, but they did. But the film, Douglas Horn, who was a researcher for the Assassination Records Review Board, which was formed in the wake of Oliver Stone's JFK called attention in the end credits to the fact that a lot of documents were still secret. And people wondered, why are they keeping these documents secret after all these years? So the Congress passed a law to release all the documents in the government's possession, unless there's some reason of national security or other legal reason. And so they released 6 million pages of documents after 1993. There's still some withheld, which is kind of astonishing after 50 years. Like the CIA is withholding some documents on national security grounds. You have to wonder, what is the national security ground after 50 years? But
yeah.
The Zapruder film, Horn did a lot of interviews with people, and he found a CIA technician named Homer McMahon and other people. McMahon worked on the Zapruder film that weekend. He was preparing briefing boards, which were big photographic blow-ups, and the CIA had a terrific photo lab that would, you know, they processed the films from the Cuban Missile Crisis and things like that. The Zapruder film was worked on by two separate photo analysts that weekend. They were working on two different versions of the film, Horn was able to prove. And one of them worked on what the film we now have. But this other version Homer McMahon worked on, he said he saw 6 to 8 shots hitting Kennedy from 3 different directions at least. And he described things like the limousine coming to almost complete stop, and other witnesses have talked about Secret Servicemen swarming around the limousine. I interviewed Senator Ralph Yarborough, who was in the car with Lyndon Johnson and his wife, 2 cars behind, and he said that when the first shots happened, men from the Secret Service follow-up car jumped out and swarmed the limousine. He said, I thought a bomb had gone off in there. And you don't see that in the Zapruder film. You only see one Secret Service man belatedly leaping off the car, but apparently a lot of them leaped around the car, and they removed that, and they removed the car coming to almost complete stop, because that would look very suspicious, because it's almost like they did that on purpose so Kennedy could be killed more easily. And some of the movements, like, for example, McMahon described blood and brain matter shooting out of the back of Kennedy's head. And you don't see that on the Zapruder film. You see very briefly a kind of a red explosion that sort of goes upward into the front.
Yeah.
And people have said that they think that was the special effect that was put on the film, and they removed the debris going behind him. The one thing they couldn't change was Kennedy's body being thrown violently backward into the left. And in JFK, they make a big point of that, and they keep saying back and to the left, back and to the left. And that was one of the things. Life magazine wouldn't let that film be seen in public for a long time. And when it finally became widely seen in 1975, a lot of people said, well, wait a second, he was obviously shot from the front because he's thrown violently backwards. And in Newton's second law of motion, that's what happens if you get shot from the front, you're thrown backwards. Some people have tried to rationalize that, but It really led to the reopening of the case by the House Select Committee and assassinations. But so the film is not the way it really happened. So for a long time, we thought that was the clock of the assassination, like it shows the intervals between shots. There's debate because you don't actually literally see bullets hitting. You see people reacting to bullets, yeah, obviously, and you don't see the shooters. So there's a lot of analysis that has to be done in this. So in one case, in one sense, the Kennedy assassination is a major case of film analysis and film criticism. And if you look at JFK, which I think is a brilliant film, there's a long section where the Jim Garrison character, played by Kevin Costner, does a long film analysis of the Zapruder film. And how many films do you see where they do film analysis in a major...
Sure.
Theatrical motion picture. So I show that in my class for a lot of reasons. Oliver Stone's film, I'll say, was attacked by a lot of people for supposedly distorting history. But frankly, I think it does a much more accurate job of depicting history the way it really happened. And the media who attacked it are wedded to the Warren Commission version, partly because they mistakenly reported that set of facts at the beginning, so-called evidence, as Oswald called it, and they don't want to admit they're wrong. And here's this filmmaker coming along and giving the alternate version. But he based it on a lot of research and documentation. So when they do that I think it's like an 18-minute sequence where Garrison said, let's just speculate for a minute and see what happened, and he does a recreation. And, you know, as Stone said, it's labeled as speculation, but he says, this is probably what happened. And I think that section of the film is by and large quite accurate, showing what happened, although Stone didn't realize the Zapruder film had been altered. So he doesn't depict some of that.
Yeah.
But he shows gunmen shooting from different directions and things not happening the way the Warren Commission reported.
Yeah, it seems to me that film, which I think is brilliantly made, is a little bit of a Rashomon tale. I mean, he does interview all these different people, and they all tell their stories. And I've read, many people have complained to me, oh, he just threw in everything he could think of, every different conspiracy theory there is.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, he structures it in a way that everybody's telling what they, either what they believe to be true or what they're lying about.
Yeah, and that was his stated purpose, and I interviewed him a couple times in the wake of the making of that film. I have to say, he's a very, you know, brilliant guy and bright guy. He was really shocked at the reaction. I could tell he was quite shaken by all the attacks on him, which I guess, you know, anybody would be, because he was treated as a demon by the media, compared him to Leni Riefenstahl and things like that. But I think he, you know, I would have been more prepared for the flack, because, you know, making a film on that subject that challenges the official wisdom is going to get a lot of attack. But I guess the level of attack was quite strong. But he started out trying to do a Rashomon thing, and I don't think the film quite does that as much as maybe he thought, because it does show different versions of things, though, that's true. And there, some people tell stories, but, you know, sometimes he intercuts the official version with what really happened. Like, there's a particularly good moment when Oswald is shown in the lunchroom being accosted by a policeman and the head of the book depository, and he's very calm and he's not out of breath, and he's supposed to have just run down six floors after shooting the president.
Yeah.
And run down there in 90 seconds. And in fact, he was in the lunchroom and he was drinking a Coke, which he had just bought. And he turned around and he looked very calm. And Stone juxtaposes that with the official version of a guy running down the stairs. And there were two women walking down the stairs who said they didn't see anybody run past them, you know. And so Stone shows those two versions of things. And that's a very good dramatization for the public of, okay, here's what they claim happened and here's what really happened. And if you run down six flights of stairs, you're going to be out of breath. And
sure.
He wasn't, according to the two people who witnessed him.
I must say that I was a little surprised at how negative the reaction was against the Stone film, because, as I said earlier on when I misused the word paranoia, all the films have come at it from the angle that things are not as we've been told.
Right.
I don't think there's been any real Kennedy assassination movie that believes the Warren Report.
Well, no, there are some, and I've read the script of Parkland, actually, and it's not good. It's going to be a bad film.
Hmm.
I have to say that, you know, sometimes you read a script and the film is better than the script, and it could change, but people attack JFK on the basis of the script ahead of time without seeing the film, so you have to, you know, reserve judgment to some extent. But Parkland takes the Warren Commission line pretty straight. It's based on Vincent Bugliosi's book, which supports the Warren Commission. It's a pretty specious book. And there are a lot of books that support the Warren Commission and try to justify it. But this is a docudrama that just follows the party line. They show Oswald as the sole shooter, et cetera. They don't really go into much about Oswald at all. It's more about the doctors and treating Kennedy and about Zapruder, and those stories are intercut. It also kind of lacks a dramatic focus. It's not actually very interesting dramatically. It shows a lot of close-up, intimate details of Kennedy's medical treatment, which are going to be pretty ghoulish if they show that.
Yeah.
And Stone did that well. He showed the autopsy, which I thought was important because the autopsy was also faked. That Another thing that, you know, there are a number of things about this case that if you had told us this in 1963, it would have been very hard for us to comprehend that the film was faked, the autopsy was faked, Kennedy's body was altered, which David Lifton and other people have written about. That, and I found documents that, I found a document that Lifton didn't have that an FBI high official wrote that they had a Kennedy's body at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and there was a bullet lodged behind his ear that they were trying to remove. And this was about 7:55 p.m. And this is not in the Warren report at all. It's not in the official evidence. They couldn't find, officially, they couldn't find a bullet in his body. And they were at a loss to know what happened. And but according to this FBI document, they removed a bullet from behind his ear, and that was the one fired from the right side of the grassy knoll, probably from the concrete retaining wall. There are probably two shooters there, one behind the retaining wall, one behind the fence. And I go into that in my book. And there was secret pre-autopsy surgery on the president's head, which two FBI agents recognized in a report. And Douglas Horn's book finds witnesses to this, that a doctor altered Kennedy's body hurriedly for about 10 minutes and took bullets out of his head. And all the doctors and nurses at Parkland Hospital said there was a large exit wound in the back of Kennedy's head the size of a baseball. And that doesn't show up in the autopsy pictures. It looks like the back of his head is intact. And instead, you see a large wound on the top and right side of his head. You know, it's like sheared off.
Yeah.
But that was not seen by the witnesses at the hospital. And so something happened between the hospital and when they had the official autopsy, and they enlarged the wound to remove evidence of shots from the front.
And you published one of those autopsy photos in the book.
Yeah, those were leaked out by a Secret Service agent. They've never been officially released. That's among the documents that are withheld, but they have become public, several of the photos. Some are still not seen, but there is a disturbing picture of Kennedy where you see his face, and you see what appear to be three wounds, one on his right temple, which I have abundant evidence of, and then it appears there's one on his forehead where a bullet apparently hit him in the top forehead, and there's the throat shot, which yeah. Doctors at Parkland gave a press conference that afternoon and said it was an entrance wound. And doctors and nurses all agreed it was an entrance wound, which tends to be small. Exit wounds tend to be large because they go through the body and
sure.
Tissue gets exploded out. But this one was a small pencil-sized wound, and the doctor had to do a tracheotomy into it and enlarge it. But he didn't make that big gash that you see in the pictures, which is very unprofessional. No doctor would make a tracheotomy like that. And he just made a small slit so they could put the tube in there. And so they obviously removed a large part of his throat, and they claimed that was an exit wound later, that because the official story is a bullet hit, you know, the back of his head and came out his throat, which didn't happen.
Yeah. The the one shot we see in the Zapruder film, when it looks like he's clutching at his throat, I think that's...
Yeah, it looks like
he holds his hands up like that.
Yeah, that's where he gets hit in the throat, and it's like an involuntary muscle reaction where his hands go up, but also it's like a self-protective reaction. Actually, what I meant to say was the official story was there was a wound in the back of his neck that went out the throat. That's the single bullet theory, and then a bullet that hit his head. The wound in the back was in his shoulder, much lower, and it was not on a path that would go out the front, and the Warren Commission altered it. Gerald Ford, who is a member of the Warren Commission, actually rewrote the report to move the wound higher so it would fit the theory, and they claimed there was just one shot in the back of his head, but in fact there were shots that hit him in the front from the front angle, different parts of his head as well that they didn't admit.
Now, one of the things that I found your book completely fascinating, of course, but one part that was really fresh material to me was your investigation into Officer Tippett.
Right.
Because he has always been kind of swept to the side, right? I mean, we just look at him as a guy who happened to be walking down the street. Oswald sees him and shoots him, and then that's it. That's the story.
Yeah, and they...
So how did you even start to look into him?
Well, you know, I've been a professional journalist since 1960. When I was a kid, I sold my first article. I've been doing this all my life. And one of the things I've learned in journalism is when part of a story is being withheld or covered up or not talked about, you should zero in on this. Psychiatrists call this the point of maximum resistance, the thing people don't want to talk about. And we encounter that in certain stories, that there's, you wonder, why is there no picture of this guy, or why we don't hear about this aspect of the case? And also, Watergate taught us that the cover-up is the key to the crime, and I learned a lot from Watergate. So Tippit, I always wondered about, you didn't read much about Tippit in the Warren Report. They hardly talk about this murder. And yet, to people who believe that Oswald did it, this is actually often brought up as a key proof that, well, he must have shot Kennedy because he shot this policeman. That people actually say this, which is not logical at all.
No.
Because you could shoot a policeman and not have shot the president, let's say. But they say that this is the proof that he shot Kennedy, that he shot Tippit. That's absurd. But there is no actual proof that Oswald shot Tippit. And if you start looking at the evidence, which is very sketchy in the Warren Report, and the House Select Committee looked into it more than other people had, but still very sketchy. And Sylvia Marr wrote probably the best book on the assassination in 1967 called Accessories After the Fact. And she said Tippit was a unknown and unknowable figure, barely mentioned in the report. And I took that as a challenge that, okay, he's not unknowable. Nobody is unknowable. You know, when I did Frank Capra's life story, I found out his life was very different from what people thought. And I found there's a tremendous amount of information on all of us out there. You can dig, if you really do the work, you
sure.
can find documents and people to talk to. So I set out to investigate this part of the case, and I realized it was important. Early on, I figured out that this was key to the case. One of the Warren Commission staff called it the Rosetta Stone of the case, and he meant it in the sense that proved Oswald did it, but I took that as in a different light, that this is the key to the case for different reasons, that why was this obscure policeman killed in Oak Cliff, soon after the assassination, and then Oswald was captured nearby? What happened there? Why was he killed? There is no evidence that Tippit would have recognized Oswald from the police radio description, which was very general, could have applied to thousands of men. But some people have speculated from the very beginning that Tippit was looking for Oswald, and I was able to prove this. One of the most important discoveries in my book, Into the Nightmare, was I interviewed Tippett's father, Edgar Lee Tippit, who was 90 years old at the time, and he lived to 104, very sharp old man. He had never been interviewed. This is an example of people just didn't
wow.
bother looking into the, you know, it's also kind of disturbing that this policeman is killed and nobody cared enough to investigate the crime, from any point of view. And the police dropped the investigation right away. But I found Mr. Tippit living in his rural home. Pretty nice old man, had some prejudices and things, but he was pretty honest, and he seemed like he was interested in finding out what happened, and he was concerned. He didn't really totally believe the Warren Report. He thought Oswald probably killed his son because, I guess, you know, that's what he had been told. But he told me an amazing thing. He said Mrs. Tippit, Marie Tippit, the officer's widow, had been visited by a Dallas policeman soon after the assassination to tell her what happened. And what this policeman told her was that he and J.D. Tippit were both assigned to go and hunt down Oswald. And this other officer said, I got into a traffic accident and I didn't make it in time, but J.D. got there and he got shot. And this is totally not in the Warren Report. This is all new information. But when I studied it in connection with all the witness reports and the police radio reports, and I found a record of an auto accident happening right around the time Tippit was shot, 11 blocks away, for example. So that story sort of checks out. I don't know who the other officer is, but I have suspicions. There were other officers behaving suspiciously in that area that day. So there is evidence, and that matches other evidence that Tippit was frantically racing around Oak Cliff looking for somebody. And what makes it proof of a plot is that the Dallas police officially didn't know who Lee Harvey Oswald was at that time, if you believe the official story. It took them until they captured him to figure out who he was. And even then he had two pieces of identification. One was an alias, allegedly. But so they didn't know who this Oswald was. And yet J.D. Tippit and this other officer were told to go and hunt down Oswald. And one has to suspect that they might have been told to kill him, you know, because, I mean, the assassin, the alleged assassin was killed 2 days later. And I think the, to cut to the chase, I think what was happening there was, there were reports that came out that Tippit was killed in a shootout with Oswald in a theater or on the street. And I think that's what was supposed to happen, that they wanted these two guys to shoot it out and maybe both of them to get killed, or at least to kill Oswald. And then I began wondering, why would Tippit possibly be sacrificed? And there is some evidence that maybe his killing was done purposely to lure other policemen away from downtown, where, instead of investigating the Kennedy assassination, to capture and kill Oswald at the theater. And in fact, that's what happened. Dozens of policemen and even Secret Service men and FBI agents converged on that area when the policeman was killed and captured Oswald, who cleverly started shouting, "I'm not resisting arrest, I'm not resisting arrest," so they couldn't kill him in the theater, which they probably were going to do. But I think Tippit may have been involved in the assassination. That's one of the theories that I studied, that he might have been the gunman on the grassy knoll behind the retaining wall. There's a photograph taken by Marianne Moorman, which has been blown up. It's like in the movie Blow Up, where they keep blowing up a picture and they see things that you couldn't see with, you know, with the naked eye. And Jack White, who is a photo expert in Dallas, Fort Worth, who I interviewed, blew up this picture and found that you can see a Dallas police officer firing a short gun, a handgun of some kind, from behind the retaining wall at the president. You see a flash in front of his face, and you see the uniform badge and patch, and you see the man's head. And one of the things that made me wonder about Tippit was, in the Warren Report, there are only two pictures of him, one from 1952 and one from 1957, and you don't get a very good look at him. And what did he look like in 63? Why didn't they run a picture of him? I found that very suspicious, and I found a couple of pictures of Tippit taken in 62 and 63, and he looked a lot different from how he looked in the 50s. He had aged and was more weathered and lost some of his hair. And it's remarkable, the hairline, he had a rather distinctive shape of a hairline, and it looks just the same as the figure firing the gun in the picture. And there are witnesses and other pieces of information that tend to support this theory that there was a policeman firing from the grassy knoll. And that's a good cover for an assassin, because people might think, well, the police are firing back, or, you know, there was a black couple who happened to witness this, and they were afraid to come forward. The woman was later interviewed and said, well, I'm a woman, I'm black, I live in Dallas, Texas, I'm not going to come forward. You know, it's understandable. But they saw a couple of men firing from the grassy knoll, at least one of whom was a policeman. And so there are ways to show that this Tippit could have been the person. But on the other side of the evidence, his wife said he was home having lunch, but she gave different times. Her stories don't really match very well, that he had left home around 11:50 or thereabouts. She gave other times too, but there was also a report that Tippit was investigating a burglary or a shoplifting at 1217 in Oak Cliff. And if he had done those things, he wouldn't have been downtown. He couldn't have been downtown. But those stories have a lot of problems with them, a lot of holes in them. And part of what's hard to investigate this case is a lot of disinformation that's been put out there, a lot of false stories and false documents, and documents have been destroyed or altered, and some false documents have been inserted into the evidence. For example, Mr. Tippit told me his son was a great shot. He said once they were walking along and they saw a hawk in a tree about 100 yards away, and J.D. said, "I'll shoot him." And the father said, "You can't." J.D. picked up a .22 rifle and shot the hawk, which is remarkable shooting.
Yeah.
But in Tippett's personnel file, the police department, there's only one document about his shooting ability, which claims that he was a mediocre shot. And it's odd that a policeman's personnel file for 11 years would have only one document about his shooting ability, because they have to keep, you know, every year they get examined for their shooting ability. And so I wondered if this document had been inserted into the record and other documents removed to make it look like he wasn't a very good shot, when in fact his father indicated he was a remarkable shot. So there's a lot about Tippett that's different from what people think. Also, he had a mistress at the time who I interviewed at great length, and she gave me a very candid interview. And she was pregnant. She just found out she was pregnant. And part of the – some people point to her husband as a possible suspect in the shooting. I actually exonerate him because I found proof that he couldn't have done it. But he said that her child was Tippett's child. She denied it to me, but the husband said the girl is Tippett's daughter, and some people have speculated that this was the cause of his shooting, that he just found out his mistress is pregnant, and the husband was pursuing them around town for a while. He was very jealous. But I think that's a red herring, but it was part of Tippett's complicated life that he had a pregnant girlfriend, and he was fooling around on his wife. He was not the kind of American hero that he was portrayed. He was part of the plot, and he was not a good family man. And he moved in the circle of a lot of right-wingers. I analyze at great length the extreme right-wing community in Dallas and other parts of Texas. And he was moving in the milieu of Jack Ruby and Oswald and other people. I think Oswald was a patriotic American who worked as an FBI informant and had infiltrated the plot against Kennedy and was reporting to the FBI. I found evidence of this. Henry Wade, the DA of Dallas, who's the man in Roe versus Wade, famous character who prosecuted Jack Ruby and would have prosecuted Oswald, told me the FBI had talked to Oswald a day or two before the shooting, which nobody knows. And I think Oswald was informing the FBI on this plot and didn't realize he was being set up as the patsy. So Alan Dulles, who is the former CIA chief who was fired by Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, was a member of the Warren Commission, which is suspicious in itself. But he said once, if they don't believe the Warren report, let them come up with other suspects. He challenged us, you know. And so I've come up with other suspects, and some of this, you know, I was able to advance the case beyond what we knew, and I think there's a lot of new material about Tippett that people never knew before. But there are some things we will never probably know completely because it's a cold case from 50 years ago, and it's hard to, you know, there's no Zapruder film of the Tippett shooting, and even if there was, it might be controversial. But I, you know, some of the witnesses died or disappeared. There's a high rate of violence surrounding the Tippett witnesses, too. That's another interesting thing. But we don't totally know what happened, but I have some suspects to point to that I think two, three, or even four men were involved in killing Tippett, none of whom was Oswald. And I have their names in the book, and I talk about why I suspect them.
Well, you talked with Lavelle, who was famously the guy who's handcuffed Oswald when Ruby shoots him.
Yeah, Jim Lavelle, the detective.
And he said something to you that I hadn't really considered before, that they didn't do a house-to-house search or questioning around the Tippett murder, which seems like basic police work that you would just look around the basic area for a block or so anyway and just talk to people and see what they had seen.
Yeah, Jim Lavelle is a very interesting man, still alive. He was the tall policeman in the white Stetson and the suit who was handcuffed to Oswald when he was shot. Very, very nice man in a lot of ways. Very honest. He was willing to talk about the case. He's read a lot about it. He knows all the issues, and he was willing to admit errors that he had made and failings in the case while still defending the department and still thinks Oswald did it. But I grilled him and DA Henry Wade very closely about the evidence, and I really got them to basically both admit they didn't have a case against Oswald either for shooting Kennedy or for shooting Tippett. And Lavelle was supposed to be the lead investigator of the Tippett case, and he got there shortly after Tippett was shot. And he was supposed to, you know, organize the crime scene investigation. And he did admit to me that he hadn't canvassed the neighborhood where you knock on doors to find all the witnesses. It was very haphazard. although I was told by a couple of researchers in Dallas that that's not totally true, that the next day, Saturday, Captain Will Fritz, the head of the homicide investigation, was actually personally out there knocking on doors, as well as some other Dallas policemen, that indicates that they didn't believe their star witness. There was a lady named Helen Markham, who was their star witness, who was a complete nightmare as a witness, who was hysterical and confused and contradicted herself, and she probably didn't even see the shooting. They relied heavily on this one flaky witness. But what they had was a bunch of people gathered after the officer was shot, and they just picked a few witnesses and took them into a lineup, and they said, yeah, Oswald did it. And, you know, they had already seen this guy on television, and he was the only one in the lineup who looked suspicious because he was protesting his innocence, and the other guys were all wearing suits and things. And, you know, here's this guy who was disheveled, and it was pretty obvious who they thought the suspect was. But they didn't really do the systematic investigation that one should. And the ballistics evidence is what the Warren report finally relied on, because Mrs. Markham was not a reliable witness. And other witnesses said, one woman named Aquila Clemens, who I dedicate the book to with a couple of other people, she was a black lady who lived nearby, said two men did it, and neither one resembled Oswald. And she was a very honest person. She disappeared after giving interview to Mark Lane and Emil D'Antonio for the film Rush to Judgment. She's never been seen again, which was disturbing. She was a very, very brave woman to come forward. And other people said they saw people who didn't resemble Oswald. Some people thought they gave descriptions of people who looked like Jack Ruby or tall, thin men, and one man said the shooter took off in a car. Oswald didn't drive, you know. And other people said there was another police car at the scene, and I think another policeman or two was involved in the shooting. So Lavelle admitted to me the ballistics evidence was a mess. It doesn't convict Oswald. They couldn't really link the bullets to his alleged gun, and they could never even... You can't even prove he owned that gun. So a lot of this could have been planted. They could have planted bullets and things. And so I got Lavelle to admit that the ballistics really was a big problem. And that's the whole case against Oswald for shooting Tippit, really, because the witnesses were not reliable. And then Henry Wade admitted problems with the evidence to me about the Kennedy assassination. He actually told the Warren Commission in a comment that was overlooked, he wasn't sure that he had enough to bring a charge against Oswald for shooting Kennedy. And he said he thought it was a hopeless case, which is quite remarkable. You know, here are these authorities, and I grilled these guys very closely, and they basically said we didn't have a case against Oswald. So I exonerate Oswald in the book.
What's amazing to me is that whoever questioned Oswald once he was in custody didn't seem to record it, or...
No, that's one of the crazy things that, you know, we would...
They didn't even take notes, did they?
Well, we would love to... Captain Will Fritz, at the time we thought nobody took notes, but Will Fritz, who was the homicide detective, the head of homicide, who was kind of a legendary character, but kind of sloppy policeman. Lavelle said he was great at getting confessions, but he was terrible at getting evidence, and, you know, and...
is that how Oswald
actually,
got the
black
eye?
Henry Wade told me that. He said he's the guy who had to prosecute these cases, and they rely on the police to collect the evidence, and he said he was terrible at getting evidence, and he had a lot of conflicts with Fritz. But Fritz was great at getting people to confess. He once got somebody to confess to a murder on the telephone, which is kind of legendary. But, you know, they also used the third degree on people in those days. The police department was corrupt. But he had some notes that surfaced later, but they're very sketchy and incomplete, and an FBI agent took a few notes, but they didn't tape record the sessions, at least as far as we know, and they claim they didn't own a tape recorder, but they could have gone out and got one even in 1963.
You'd think, yeah.
You could walk over across the street to a store and buy one. But it would be so great to have all those. He was interviewed for, you know, 12 hours, something like that. We don't really know what he said. We have reports, secondhand reports, that we have to take with a grain of salt from the authorities that he said this and he said that. But he consistently denied the shootings. even from their accounts. And when he was shown on television, I watched it on TV where he said, "I didn't shoot anybody, no sir, and I'm just a patsy, and I haven't committed any act of violence." And he had that brief midnight press conference where he said, "I don't know what this is about, except that I'm accused of murdering a policeman. And I wish somebody would come forward to give me legal assistance." I was really kind of horrified by that when I saw that, that here's this guy, never had a lawyer, and we don't know what he said. Because
he got a black eye.
Yeah, they hit him in the theater, and they probably were trying to shoot him. And they claimed that he had tried to shoot a policeman, and the revolver misfired. But there's an FBI agent who was an expert on ballistics who said that the round in the revolver was not dented. If somebody had tried to fire it, it would have been dented. So that wasn't true either. So here's a guy, we don't know what he said, and then he was murdered in police custody, never had a trial. If he had been brought to trial, we would have learned an awful lot, obviously. It's a sad story of, but you know, I think the part of this is incompetence. It's easy for people to say, well, police departments are incompetent, the FBI is incompetent. Well, they're not that incompetent. I think they blew this case on purpose. They didn't really pursue the investigation of the Tippit murder because Oswald was shot and they thought they had enough people. You know, Lavelle said, well, we had some witnesses, and, you know, they didn't really do a thorough job. Even to honor Tippit's memory, they should have pursued the case, and they just dropped it. And then with Kennedy's shooting was horribly investigated. Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, wrote it 4 o'clock that afternoon, which was very shortly after the shooting. You know, we have the man. And there's no way you could know within a couple hours that only this guy did this. It's ridiculous. You know, so they had some preconceived notion.
Sure.
Just like they knew, why did they send Tippit out to find Oswald? They had Oswald pegged as the guy they wanted to lay the case on. And why did they do that? Well, he worked for the FBI, and he was an apparent leftist who had gone to Russia, apparent defector. But I think he was a false defector who was a spy for the U.S. The Russians thought he was, too, that they found him suspicious. And the CIA had a false defector program where they would send people to the Soviet Union as spies. And this is not uncommon in spy craft to have people pose as defectors so they can get into a country and spy on. And that's what Oswald was doing. So he was a convenient scapegoat for this crime, which was never properly investigated. And consistently since then, 70% of the American public doesn't believe the official story. That's always been the case, except for a brief time after the Warren Report came out. There was a little dip in that. But so most of us don't believe the official story, and yet our life goes on. It's not normal, as Dan Rather liked to think, but we live in this world in which the president was murdered and the case was never solved. And so our government, in my opinion, is not a legitimate government and has not been since 1963. And a lot of the terrible things we've seen since then, like undeclared wars and illegal wars and torture and all kinds of bad things, stem from that anarchic abdication of the law that happened in 1963, in my opinion.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and I enjoyed it and was troubled by it, and I recommend it to anybody interested in this subject. And I can't imagine anybody who isn't interested in this subject. It tells us so much about what our country was and what it became, and it's just the ultimate mystery story in a way. But you brought a lot of light to the story, too. I really was impressed with it.
So. Thank you, Frank. I really appreciate hearing that from you, because I know you're a really good American historian, and you also know a lot about Texas history. So a lot of this book is about Texas and the whole right-wing milieu back then and what our country was like and, you know, what the conflict between our ideals and the reality. So I appreciate your praising the book, and I find that very very gratifying. Thank you so much. And I think everybody is interested in this subject. I'm getting a lot of people saying they're fascinated by this topic.
Yeah, I think it's been part of our lives. I mean, as I said before, I don't think anybody who was a conscious living person at that time doesn't remember all about it, and it's been a little bit of a shadow over our heads ever since.
And the younger people may not, you know, people who weren't there at the time, sometimes they say young people aren't interested in history, but I think a lot of people are. I was when I was a kid, you were.
Oh, sure.
And I think anybody who lives today would like to know how did we get in this fix, and it's, Norman Mailer called it the Great American Mystery, and it certainly is. I think I dispel some of the mystery that was part of my mission, but parts of it are still mysterious, and we'll continue investigating this forever.
Yeah.
As William Faulkner said, the past is not over. It's not even the past.
Yeah. And this, you know, there are definitely things about this case that I'd never considered until I read your book, and things that I never knew. So, as much as I've read about the case, and I think I've read a pretty fair amount. Certainly, I haven't devoted myself to it as you have, but I've read a lot of books about it, and this shed some light on some things I did not know. So it was definitely a worthwhile project.
Thank you. Well, that makes me feel good. I spent 31 years, and this is my life's work, really. I've been bothered by this for 50 years, and I've been spending a lot of my life. And it's partly my tribute to John F. Kennedy. I worked for him, helped in a very small way, you know, as part of getting him elected. And I didn't want to just drop the case like a lot of people did and forget about it. I just wanted to keep trying to find out what happened to this man who I admire today and which we had with us.
Well, thanks for being on the show, Joe. I really appreciate it. We'll do the again and talk movies next time.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was terrific, Frank. Thank you for your great questions.
Hope you enjoyed that. I realize that it's an unprecedented third appearance. This is the first time that's happened on this show. A couple of people have done two-parters, but this is the first time a guest has come back for a third time. And let me make a promise to you, Joseph McBride will be back for a fourth time, and I hope eventually a 12th time. You will see when you go to his page on the CommentaryTrack.com website what remarkable books he has written on Frank Capra and John Ford and Howard Hawks and Steven Spielberg and more. And of course, this new book, Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit, which is a little bit out of the realm of what he's written otherwise, but in the sense of something that has been thoroughly researched and followed and thought out, it's very much of a piece with everything he's done. So I hope that you will read lots of his books, and especially this one at the time, because this, as you know, the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination is coming up this November. I want to thank my wife, Claire McCullough, sometimes known as Claire Thompson. I'll do a little sidebar. We just finished watching the latest episode of Dexter. He's giving his girlfriend Hannah a fake passport, and she reads what the name is, and it's Claire Thompson. That's my wife's name, Claire Thompson. But anyway, I want to thank her for being my fugitive and also my announcer. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for the music, and of course, James Hutchins for designing the CommentaryTrack.com and my personal website, FrankThompson.tv. I hope you'll go to both of them, and I hope that you will order lots of books and records and CDs. And there are no records, and there are no CDs, but there are DVDs, and I don't know what I was talking about. But whatever you see there, I hope that you'll order it, whatever it is. I got a poster for the lost remake of Beaugest that's for sale, too, a mere $10 with free postage. Come on. It's beautiful. So whatever you see on the website, just order it. Don't ask questions. Just start ordering. And I think you'll love everything you get. So, we got another great show coming up again next week, and I hope that you will be with us then. In the meantime, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.